Hi, I'm Rob Kendall, and this is the Front End Podcast.
The Front End Podcast explores the ins and outs of life as a developer. We delve into challenging topics around modern day development and technology, including learning, professional growth, programming languages, frameworks, tools, techniques, UX, UI, careers, and so much more. Episode 8 of the Front End, here we are. Not that many in, but still very exciting nonetheless. And we are very excited and very honoured to have with us today Emma Bostian. Hello, Emma.
Hi, thanks for having me.
That's all right. Thank you very much for coming on. Now, I'm going to apologise up front if I ever pronounce your name as Bostonian, because I don't know what your brain does, but mine sometimes reads a word and says, this is how it's pronounced, and for some reason went Bostonian, and that is now locked away in my brain, so I have to work very hard to say Bostian, and also not to do some kind of Will Hunting impression like Wicked Smart with the Boston side of things. Emma, in her own, that's okay. Emma, in her own words, is a software engineer, blogger, speaker, teacher, and cat mum. Now, I'm not sure which one of those you would place more importance on. I'm going to say the cat mum bit.
Oh, evidently, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. We had two dogs. I'm horribly allergic to cats, otherwise we probably would have some. But we lost both our dogs earlier in the year, but I would normally identify more as a dog dad, I suppose. But yeah, very, very, very honoured to have you on the show. Thank you very much for coming on. I'm going to talk a little bit about tech tests and that awful part of the kind of, or it's for me, the development hiring process where we get to the dreaded kind of technical interviews that really test your knowledge and your mettle. But I'd like to ask you a little bit about how you got into development things, because I see from your website that you were very much, no, I'm not interested in development. That's not a route I want to go down. And then you ended up being what you are now, a very successful software developer with a CS degree, no less. So how did you kind of go from absolutely being, nope, that's not what I want to do, and then kind of going down the path where you are now?
Well, I mean, I sucked at the other thing I was doing. I was a biology major my whole life. I grew up, I wanted to be an OBGYN. I wanted to deliver babies professionally for a living, which is a strange profession for like a five-year-old to want to have, but that's what I wanted to do. And I grew up with two parents who worked for IBM, one who still does. My mom just retired, but she was a senior UX designer, and my dad was an architect, so he was a back-end developer. And I would always go to like the IBM bring your kid to work days. And it felt very archaic to me. It didn't seem very exciting or anything like that. So I kind of had this stigma in my mind of, well, my parents are pushing me into this, so therefore I'm going to do the exact opposite. And I started out biology and I absolutely hated it. I almost failed my first semester of college. I had like a 2.7 GPA because I really basically failed chemistry and biology. And so at that point, I was like, well, I like math. I'll switch into actuarial science and study statistics. And that's where I took intro to programming. And so that's kind of my first introduction to it. And I remember really enjoying hex and binary and learning about the history of computing and things like that. So at that point, that's when I switched to computer science.
And I like that your dad's still at IBM. Do you ever get together with him and do like little Bostian hackathons?
No, absolutely not. He hates web development. Actually, he texts me all the time. Anytime he finds an issue with like a front end form, he'll like complain about it to me for hours and talk about how much he hates web development, and then I should switch back to back end development. I mean, he's being cheeky, of course, but yeah, no, we don't.
it's nice to go on a slightly related tangent. I have I suppose we're in a quite similar situation. I have a six-year-old daughter, and it's always kind of one of those, I'd love her to go into development, because if nothing else, it's like, I can teach you things. That would be great. But she's dead set on being, it was a doctor, weirdly, but then not maybe an OBGYN or gynecologist as we know them. But she just wants to be a singer-dancer.
I think that you kind of need to let this is my personal take given how I went about life. But for me, when I have kids in the future, I think it's going to be one of those where you got to kind of let them find their own path, and ultimately they'll end up where they want to be. But my parents, they always advised me, I don't think there was a point in time in college during my biology issue where I actually applied to a secondary college and got in for music education. I was really convinced I wanted to switch for music. And my dad sat me down and he goes, I don't agree with this. I don't think it's going to be the best for your career decision, because he was right. I mean, I wasn't an aficionado when it came to playing trumpet or piano. I was decently good, but I wasn't good enough to really make it in a tough industry. But he let me ultimately make my own decisions. He told me, I don't think that this is a viable career path for you, but I support you. And at that point, I was like, you know what? He's right. And I made that decision myself. But yeah, I would say don't force your children. For me personally, I would not force my children into something that they seemingly don't want to do. I'd let them kind of figure it out on their own.
That's a good message for, I think, any podcast, but especially for an end one. Yeah, don't pressure your kids and stuff. My wife and I are very much like that. I mean, she absolutely loves, she does a drama class, which she's now doing it online, and that's a bit weird, but it seems to work. But she loves singing and dancing and drama, and we're very much crack on. You want to be good at that, love, do it. I mean, I think the only thing we'd probably have a problem with, if she wanted to be like a career criminal.
Of course.
maybe not. There's other options out there for you. But yeah, she does quite like the STEM stuff, which is something we're obviously quite keen to encourage, because I think that opens up quite a different number, like a multitude of paths for you.
Definitely. It's cool because there are a lot of fields in tech that you don't realize you can mesh with other areas in your life. So like if you are really interested in drawing, if you want to think about art, well, if you also like technology, why don't you blend those two and become a visual or graphic designer, right? Or if you enjoy logic puzzles, but you don't want to, I don't know, what other things? Like you don't want to be a detective. I don't know. you know, computer science is a really great field for that. And so for me, I loved music, but it wasn't something I thought I could make a decent living at. But now look at me, I'm going to be joining Spotify. So I'll get to work on music software as a software engineer. And so it's pretty cool to be able to blend those two passions.
Are you going to become a featured artist on Spotify, do like your own music, and then work for the company that hosts that music as well?
Absolutely not. No one would buy it. But I did find out that they do have bands there. So they have like a choir that I can join. I think they offer guitar lessons. Like they have plenty of different opportunities for continuing your music.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. And speaking of Spotify, it's a nice segue into, you know, the congratulations on the new role. I saw on Twitter.
Oh, thank
you. Was that a pretty grueling process to get in Spotify?
No, I actually really enjoyed the process, surprisingly, because the tech interview process is not enjoyable. I was going through the interview process with Google at the time, and that was a grueling process. They're notorious for having very difficult interviews. And granted, I had a very good experience with them, but I got to the point where, you know, COVID-19 kind of became more prevalent and hiring slowly decreased and things were up in the air. And so I kind of reached out to my old contact at Spotify and I said, hey, are you hiring? So, you know, just to do a couple in tandem. And it ended up being one of the best processes that I've gone through for the tech industry. It was a lot of interviews. I would say I had like a coding interview. And then after that went well, I had quote unquote on-site interviews, which would have been in Stockholm, but they were remote. So I had a systems design, data structures, an algorithms interview, and then another front-end interview, and then one with a hiring manager. But it was really great. I thought the questions were very practical. They had two interviewers, which was nice to help. It felt more conversational. It felt less of an interview.
It's nice to hear that you got something out of the process, because again, I think some companies take it as this kind of gauntlet that, like, we are this mighty company, you want to work for us, lowly engineer, you've got to prove to us your kind of worth. And really, I think it's got to be a bit of a, at least, you know, even if it's weighted a bit more towards the company end, it's got to be a two-way process, because you're working out whether they're a fit for you as much as you are for them. So it's good that they managed to fulfill their side of it with the technical elements. But they made it enjoyable for you as well.
I think that's what people forget, is you're also interviewing them. And I think a lot of companies forget that as well. Like you're talented, you've got something to offer them. They're spending their time interviewing you, which means they're decently interested in you. So don't forget that it's a two-way conversation.
Now, this episode's, you know, we're going to talk about the kind of tech portion of it. I suppose it's the technical interview portion of the interview process. Now, you've had your fair share, I would say you've probably had your fair share of technical interviews. What are your kind of opinions on technical interviews and coding tests?
I think they're a necessary evil, but I think that there's a proper way to do it and an improper way to do it. So I am personally not a fan of asking direct definition questions of like define a promise or what's a closure. I don't like those types of questions, because as someone who struggles with memory, I can't memorize things for the life of me. I failed history. I swear to God, like I was just horrible at anything that required any level of memorization. And so when I get put on the spot and ask these definitions, I seize up. But when we're talking about coding questions, I think it's very important to be empathetic towards your interviewee, because this is a very stressful situation. Many people are not interviewing for the fun of it. They're interviewing because they've been laid off or they have to. Maybe that their visa is on the line. We forget this. There are a lot of international candidates who need a visa to stay in their country, which is my position currently. So people aren't interviewing for fun. They're interviewing because they have to. And we need to ask them relevant questions. So don't ask them to find a broken edge in a binary search tree if they're going to be working primarily in web development on, you know, a food delivery application. If they have to touch a binary search tree for whatever reason, they're not going to need to memorize how to code one or all the nuances of it. So ask them practical questions. This is something Spotify did with me that I thoroughly appreciated. Every question they asked was relevant, but it also encompassed multiple facets of web development. So it had a CSS, it had HTML, it had accessibility, it had JavaScript versus just these JavaScript heavy solutions. So yeah, and one other positive interview I remember having was they gave me multiple options for questions. So I actually interviewed with Gatsby and my friend Jason was interviewing me and he gave me three different questions that I was able to answer, which I thoroughly appreciated because some of them I just flat out didn't know. And there's nothing more traumatizing than being asked a direct technical interview question and you flat out don't know the answer. So being provided with options of questions to pick one from was very, very helpful.
Oh, that is great. And it's so nice. It's so life-affirming to hear someone else say, I struggle with remembering things. Because I had an interview, I've just changed, or in the process of changing jobs. And the interview I had with four tech leads, which was kind of intimidating enough, but they were firing like a lot of definition questions, like what's ACID in terms of database? And
what does
REST mean? And it was I've forgotten what the actual thing stands for because it's very, there's a lot of pressure and it's 8 o'clock at night because of the time zones and it was just weird. But, you know, I could explain the kind of maybe the difference between how REST will do something versus something like GraphQL. So that seemed to appease them. But yeah, that was tough.
Yeah. And oh my gosh, I had a point. I was just going to forget. Talking about memorizing things. Say I told you I can't remember anything. There's a good book called Make It Stick that we're reading right now for our Ladybug podcast book club group. And it's all about the science of learning. And I want to be very clear that there's a harsh difference between learning and memorizing. If you don't understand underlying concepts, you're not going to be as successful in these interviews because you're going to be just spitting out definitions if you can remember them. This was something I did horribly, was I just tried to memorize these things. I didn't understand what a closure was. I tried to memorize the definition and that really hindered my ability. So I'd recommend that book if you're struggling to learn a lot of these concepts. Maybe understand how we like retain information and build new synapses in our brain and all of that. How does our brain actually encode information? It's a very important subject that I think we all take for granted.
Yeah, absolutely. Now you touched a little bit in one of your last answers about, I see this where I've lost my point. We talk about memory. It's just horrendous. You touched a little bit about, you know, useful gauge of someone's knowledge and things. And I asked around that question because my experience with technical interviews, now this might be the UK version and, you know, I've not applied for any kind of top tier companies that might do it differently, but I think some of them ask a little bit too much of candidates. Like you said, they're either very bullet pointy, you know, acronym based questions as if that somehow proves kind of, you know, just like you said, determines that you've memorized something. A lot of them will have a very long coding challenge that's maybe like 5, 6, 7 hour plus. And for me, I feel like that asks a little bit too much of people, like for free, especially if they're in a situation where with COVID, a lot of people are made redundant. They don't maybe have the time or the inclination to spend days doing kind of free work, if you like, to just prove that they're good at doing something. So, I mean, do you think there's a good balance to be had with these kind of practical projects?
Okay, so you're talking coding projects, not coding challenges. So I differentiate these because coding challenges to me are either on a website where it's a time challenge and you have to come up with a solution, or it's like a 1 hour video call. So that's what I would call a coding challenge. The coding project is a whole different situation. I personally like them. I think that they are a better representation of the work that a candidate can do because it simulates the real world. But that being said, we have to scope these projects because I have also been given projects that I've spent 4 days straight working on just to get a rejection, which is absolutely ridiculous. So there was an example with HelloFresh actually in Berlin, and I had the worst experience with them. I was so mad about it. And that's the other thing. Your candidates are going to remember if they have a crappy experience with you, and they will not be willing to work with you when you reach back out. So just remember that, because I've been in that position where I've been treated horribly when I didn't have a Twitter following. I was a no one. And then suddenly I have this platform and now you want to interview me again. Well, guess what? I remember how you treated me. So sorry, that was me being a little bit salty. But anyway, this take-home coding project they gave me was to redesign basically their entire homepage. And I was like, are you absolutely kidding me right now? They wanted me to redo their app. And that was free unpaid labor, which is totally messed up. But they also didn't tell me, hey, we wanted to see you use React or Vue. So I wrote the whole thing vanilla JavaScript. And my only feedback was like, oh, we actually wanted you to use a framework. I'm like, well, you should have actually told me that, because I could have. It was ridiculous. But I've also had really good coding projects. For the Google process, I was given two options to choose from that tested different skills. They were very scoped, but I personally think that coding projects are a much better representation of my skill set. I do not do well under pressure, under live coding challenges. So having the ability to search the web for these APIs that I need or use a UI framework to build out a really nice looking interface, I do much better in those. And I do think many candidates do. But yeah, to your point, they can be very time consuming. So please just make sure that they're scoped.
Yeah, I agree. That's mainly my beef with them. I like them as a, like you said, as a representation of kind of mainly how people think, because I don't think, you know, development's one of those such a broad thing. You know, you can get the right answer a million different ways. And one of the interesting things I read, it was a guy on YouTube whose name escapes me, but I should put a link to it in the show notes. It was a coding challenge that his friend had kind of thought about, which was this FizzBuzz thing. I don't know if you'd heard of that.
Oh, yeah.
I really quite liked that because it was quite simple. I mean, in terms of solution, was maybe only 20 lines of code or so, but it was great to see, like, look, there's loads of different ways we can approach it. How do you approach it? How do you think? You know, are you quite terse? Are you a bit more expanded in how you write your code and things? And yeah, I agree. I like them, but they do need to be very scoped. I've had my fair share of those where, you know, it's just someone give me a PSD, which was difficult enough because if you don't have the software to open it, it's a bit tricky. But they're just, oh yeah, recreate this, and it was a similar thing, like a shopping cart, and it was just, well, how long do you want to spend? What does it want to do? Do you want it? So I kind of just flat out refused. They ended up offering me the job anyway, but it was one of those where I was like, you know, within minutes of setting foot in the door, you're like, yeah, I don't want to work here. This isn't where I want to spend a large amount of my time.
Yeah, and I think I want to caution employers, though, like, please don't reuse the most popular coding questions. And if you do, change them, because if you're giving candidates FizzBuzz or asking them to do a to-do application, yes, those test very vital skills, and they're decently practical. But that being said, many candidates have memorized the solutions to these problems. So if you're going to be giving things that test recursion or, I don't know, whether or not you can use certain array methods or understand big O, like, find the same types of questions that are a little bit different, that, because otherwise you're getting candidates who've just memorized these, like recursive Fibonacci. Like, there are 1,000 solutions on the internet for Fibonacci. So please, like, change them up, because otherwise you're just going to get people who've simply memorized.
Yeah. And with some of the, you know, you mentioned some of the more algorithmic or kind of more CS-based, I would say, things like the binary search tree and stuff like that. How realistic do you find those kind of questions? Or is it like you said, where it completely depends on the application? Because I'll be honest, if you threw some of those at me, I've got a lot of years experience as a developer, but I do not come from a kind of CS background. So there is, and I acknowledge this, a big chunk of my knowledge in terms of core computer science knowledge, like some of the popular algorithms or search trees and things like this, that I will be missing. So yeah, I suppose some technical interviews will focus on those kind of very algorithmic data tree, data structures, things like this. How realistic do you think they are in terms of development, or does it just completely depend on the application?
I'm not super sure. Like, some of these things make sense to test. So having a tree, for example, understanding a tree data structure is important, because guess what? The DOM is a tree. And so it's important to understand how to traverse that. But I don't think a lot of these data structures, like linked lists, do I need that as a web developer? I'm not sure. On the backend side, yeah, you might touch that. But I think we forget that a lot of developers these days are not coming from a traditional background, whether they're self-taught, whether they've gone through bootcamp. They don't teach data structures and algorithms or computer science concepts in these programs. And I personally would love to see these things taught as more of an apprenticeship on the job if they're needed. I don't see why we need to test them I'm talking about specific, very, so like tries, for example. Tries are a great example of a data structure that are very efficient, especially for like word searching. So if you think about when you type letters into Google, it populates a drop-down list with different string matches. You can use a try for that. A try is essentially a tree where you have different paths that have different letters and possibilities, and you kind of traverse looking for matches. It's a very efficient algorithm, but it's a very efficient data structure. However, a lot of people don't even know this exists. And if, like, you shouldn't necessarily be testing that in a job interview. How often are you going to be recreating Google search? these are things where if they need it on the job, if you hire a good candidate with a desire to learn new skills and good problem-solving capabilities, like, they'll be able to pick this stuff up on the job. I would steer away from testing these hardcore data structures and algorithms concepts.
I think that's how I got the job I've just won, through having a lot of moxie and a kind of can do it kind of attitude. Because the test I was given was they didn't get into anything in depth. It was, like you said, it was more kind of acronyms and things like that. They didn't get into anything in depth like data structures. But the test was to create like an AWS, various AWS functions using serverless framework, and all of these things were like, this is brand new information to me, but I managed to kind of pull it out of the bag somehow. And I think that's probably what got me in the end. Have you done any interviewing yourself? And if so, do you have a favorite kind of technical question or a set of questions that you like to test people with?
It's really funny because I have been that person who has fought so hard to be in interviews, and I feel like I've just been ignored, which is ridiculous because you should have diverse interviewers on your interview panel. it's kind of ridiculous, actually. I know I'm not the most diverse person in the world. I'm still a middle-class white woman, and I recognize that. But at the same time, if you have zero women on your interviewing panels, if you have zero people of color, intersectional people, queer people, you're not doing anyone any justices at that point. So it's funny because at IBM and at LogMeIn, I have pushed so hard to be invited as an interviewer. And I've sat in on a few, but it has been me consistently saying, I want to be part of this. Can you add me to the schedule? And every time they say, yeah, sure. And they never do. And at some point I just gave up. And it was really freaking frustrating because this is something that's very important. You need to have diverse interviewers. And when you just have the same cookie cutter type of person interviewing, guess what? You're only going to hire the same type of candidate. However, when I did interview, there were some questions I enjoyed asking. I really liked asking about how they stay relevant in the industry. How do you get update? Like, what's your favorite new feature coming out in JavaScript, HTML, CSS? How do you stay relevant to see, do they read blogs? Do they like to read books? How do they get their development news, I guess? Because it shows that they still like to learn, but it doesn't test these finite, there's no right or wrong answer here.
Yeah, I like that. That's really good. I quite like that. And interestingly, about the diversity that was brought up when I interviewed my friend Bethan, who's very keen. She's very much into feminism and ethics and all that kind of side of it. And we were talking about diversity because I think that's one of the things in tech that I think it's improving. There's still a long way to go, but you're right. It's a bunch of pasty white dudes hiring other pasty white dudes, and I say this as a pasty white dude myself. But that's how you end up with just this traditional suite of open plan office with just lots of white dudes.
To be honest, it makes me really angry. And if it makes me angry, I can only imagine how it makes other people from underrepresented minorities feel. And this really has been weighing on me a lot for many reasons. But one of the things about Spotify is they have diversity inclusion on our website, part of their hiring process. It's in the it's in every aspect of their hiring process. And I thoroughly appreciated that. But, I hear the excuse all too often, well, the area of Germany that we're in is primarily white, or it's hard to find women engineers. I'm like, that is such a lame excuse, and it's not a good excuse. It's sad. If you're not making this a priority in your hiring process, that's on you. And ultimately, you're seeing backlash on this in the media, and I don't understand why this is not a priority for people. But yeah, this has been a huge issue for me emotionally to get over it, and it should be on everyone's radar.
Absolutely, it should be. I'm not in a position, I haven't been in kind of part of my old company that I had a small freelance thing, and we didn't really take on a lot of staff, but as an employee, I don't have much power to help influence that other than, you know, talking about it a lot. In my own life, I suppose I do try to expand my diverse horizons by, well, like following people like yourself, you know, and a diverse range of people on Twitter. You know, you find actually I skew more towards diversity, if you like, in terms of people I kind of follow rather than just the same people like myself, in the hope that it broadens my horizons.
You know? Well, I see a lot of people argue like, well, you know, we shouldn't just offer underrepresented minorities jobs because, you know, that's unfair to them and to the other candidates. And I'm like, I don't think that's what people are advocating for. I think what people are advocating for, I could be mistaken, but I think is we're not even interviewing, we're not even giving these people a chance to prove their skills. And that's a huge problem. If you're not even reaching out to underrepresented minorities, they don't even have the chance to apply for this role. That's the problem. It's not we're trying to give job offers to underrepresented people because they're underrepresented. It's we don't even try to, we don't even give them a seat at the table to prove their skills. And that's a huge problem.
Yeah, no, it really is. We could talk about diversity all day, and you know, I think I might bring in it'd be nice to get someone on like yourself and talk about have a dedicated episode to diversity and how to help improve it, especially in the hands of the many. You know, if you're not in a position to influence the hiring, you know, how can you do your sort of part? But back to with interviews, you're currently writing a book called Decoding the Interview Process, which is awesome. And I see from Twitter it's gone very well in its initial, what was it, like a pre-launch kind of sale that you did?
Yeah, it was. It was, I sold copies before I had written it. So yeah, that was a pre-launch strategy, yeah.
Oh, that was good. And yeah, it seems to have gone really well. And whilst I haven't actually seen the book, I think that is a hugely valuable resource for people. When does it officially go on sale to the general public?
I have no idea. I'm working with Egghead to transform this into a 3-tiered offering. So the lowest tier will be the book, but it'll be revised. So it will have all the mistakes fixed that people have been kind enough to reach out and let me know, hey, this formatting is wrong, or you wrote the wrong function name or something. So we'll fix those things. We'll probably update the look and feel and the graphics. The second tier and third tier will be more video content and additional assets for you to use. I'm not sure exactly what. We're going to iterate on that. But this is going to take a little while to produce. The biggest thing is I'm moving to a foreign country in 2 months. So realistically, I can't tell you when this is going to be out. We'll have to work out the kinks. But if you want to be notified with updates, like, you can go to technicalinterviews.dev and sign up for the newsletter. And I will let you know when I get updates on when it'll be out again.
That's brilliant. What sort of tips and tricks and things have you got in there?
Oh, everything from how to problem solve, what is big O notation? How would you recognize that in a code example? I gave some practice coding project ideas. I also have a section on tips for hiring managers and interviewers, although I would really like to expand that section and perhaps even bring on a hiring manager to discuss this as an expert. So
is it language agnostic, but do you have to have some kind of CS background to get the most out of it, or is it fairly pick up and play by kind of anyone?
I think anyone can get something out of it. The diagrams and explanations are in plain English and are language agnostic, but the actual solutions are in JavaScript. I see so many resources for coding challenges and data structures and algorithms problems that are in backend languages, and I was just so sick of it. There were a few courses. Kyle Shevlin has a course on Egghead. Tyler Clark has a course on Egghead. And there are a few on front-end masters as well that do explain these things in JavaScript. But there has not, like, Cracking the Coding Interview by, I think it's Gail McDowell. I could be mistaken, but Gail, yeah, I think it's McDowell. It's all written using Java, if I'm not mistaken. And it's really hard. It's hard for people to grasp these concepts if you're only using a backend language. So I wanted the explanations and diagrams to be language agnostic, but the coding to be done in JavaScript.
That is awesome. I'm Java certified. I got it what feels like hundreds of years ago. Never actually got a job using Java at all. But at least I could probably understand parts of the book if they were in Java. But JavaScript, that's good to hear. Which brings me on to a good point and a final question. What are your thoughts on CS degrees? I'm going to say slightly biased, given that you've got one, but Twitter, and it might just be the American Twitter, but they seem very obsessed with to the point where they seem anxious about having the CS degree or not, and whether it's going to impact their sort of job. So someone with a CS degree like yourself, what do you think they are a kind of a necessary and vital part? What would your kind of recommendations to people be?
I think that getting a CS degree gives you the privilege to be more appealing to a recruiter looking for a specific type of candidate. It gives you the privilege to be able to apply for some jobs. A lot of jobs require you have a college degree. However, I don't think that the knowledge necessarily obtained during that degree is better than knowledge that you would gain from a boot camp or from taking other online courses. You can learn these skills that you would gain during a computer science degree. You can gain them through these online learning platforms. But yeah, the privilege that comes along with that degree is definitely a benefit that I wish we didn't need to have in this industry. I think hiring managers and companies needed to alter their standards here. They're missing out on a ton of great candidates because they're looking for someone with a computer science degree. And I think that's utter BS. I think they need to change their mindset. If we can change our mindset that we don't need computer science degrees or a college degree at all to hire a great candidate, you've just opened up a huge pool of applicants who, you know, would be thriving at your company, giving you the benefit of their talent. So unfortunately, I do think to some extent it has definitely helped me get a job. I wish that were not the case, and I would like to challenge that all hiring managers and companies really rethink that. My brother, for example, he went to a very good college. He went twice and dropped out twice. And he is one of the most brilliant developers I've ever met. He is very motivated. He is full stack, but he does not have a college degree. And that has not stopped him from essentially carrying this company in a time of need. So, when you are doing your hiring process, please examine whether you really need a degree, because I can assure you that there are many candidates without a degree at all who will kick butt at your company and will bring a lot of benefit.
Amazing. Thank you for that. Thank you for that, for your thoughts. So I'm going to wrap it up there. Thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate that you're immensely sort of popular and busy person, not least of all with an impending move to another country. Best of luck with that.
Thank you.
We've moved around a lot in pretty much the same area, but that alone is a bit of a nightmare, never mind to a whole completely different country. May you and your cats get there safely.
Thanks.
Do you have anything you'd like to plug, anything else you want to mention while we're here?
Nothing I want to plug, but I do just want to encourage anyone listening. If you are struggling with being surrounded by diverse people, if you are in a position where you don't feel like you're surrounded by people who you identify with, or you want to diversify the people that you associate with, like, I highly encourage you to get on Twitter and, like you said, Rob, to seek out people who are different from you, because you can learn a lot from them. And, that's just my takeaway.
No, I absolutely agree. Give Emma a follow on Twitter. She is just at Emma Bostian. She's only got a few followers, so she could do with some more. this is going to be like the most hipster thing I've ever said. It's like I followed you before you were big, before you got to the big time and sold out.
Oh, you were an OG, huh?
I was. Well, you one of the few. I know it must be a nightmare with so many followers, and I can only imagine what that is, what that must be like. But you, I would imagine, like most people, you have this giant followers to following ratio. But you actually, when I think I found you when you were about 15,000, maybe you'd followed my friend Dave Hill, who I used to work with at the University of York. And I was always like, oh, I wonder if I can get Emma to follow me because she's super popular.
Well, I just went and followed you because I've seen your avatar. And the thing is, like, it's so weird because I'll interact with the same people, but I just won't follow them. And it's nothing personal. But I think people take that so personally. I'm like, I know I do. I do. I'm a hypocrite, but.
No, that's very kind of. Oh, look, it just says follows you on Twitter. I'm very excited. Yeah, so it's I appreciate it. Must be an absolute nightmare to have that level of following, and yeah, you, like you said, people take it. I think the worst thing is people feel that you probably owe them something just because you're popular, and that's such a weird way. It's like when people meet celebrities in real life, and you're like, look, they're doing their washing or they're doing whatever, and you're kind of badgering them. They don't owe you anything just because
some people get so angry if you don't respond right away. I'm like, do you know how many messages I have? And I respond to 99% of them as long as they're not rude. But like, oh gosh, people feel entitled to your time. It's ridiculous.
They do. And you know, I think you do amazing, because I'd put my phone straight in the bin if I had that many messages.
I think about it.
So thank you very much for that. Do give Emma a follow. You can find all the links, if you just find her on Twitter, at Emma Bostian. You can find links to other things, like she has the Ladybug podcast, which is also on Twitter, at Ladybug podcast. I will ask Emma for a few links and things to put in the show notes that she'd like in there. But yeah, keep do give her a follow. Watch out for a book. Thank you very much for coming on again.
Yes, thank you for having me.
So that's it for this episode. Do consider subscribing and give us a like or a share on social media. Speaking of which, if you'd like to follow the show, we're available on Twitter at Frontend Podcast. You can follow me, Rob Kendall, on Twitter too, at Kendall Mint Code. If you'd like to find out more about the show, sponsor an episode, or be a guest, you can find out more on the dedicated website, thefrontendpodcast.site.